morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Today is Monday, June 15th, 2009. And this is Air Cascadia, long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Nestle wants the water in salmon spawning streams near Cascade Locks.
David Rosenfeld is back today with an assessment of the pitch for public-private as co-op.
And a Portland police officer was arrested Friday afternoon on dozens of charges of official misconduct and harassment.
Portland area weather, partly sunny with a high near 75. Tonight, mostly dark with a low around 56. And more of the same tomorrow.
And first we go to regional news from around Cascadia. Northern Star Natural Gas, the developer of a proposed Columbia River liquefied natural gas terminal, said last week that it recently raised tens of millions of dollars. And now it has enough money to finish the arduous regulatory process for the project. Joining us this morning with an update on the LNG situation is Brett Vandenheuvel with Columbia Riverkeeper. Good morning, Brett. Thank you so much for being with us.
Morning, Chris.
Well, so we haven't heard very much last week from the front lines and the struggle with the LNG, particularly the Bradwood Landing issues. Can you give us a brief update on the current situation? Apparently, what it all boils down to now, this, even from the mouths of the developers themselves, is money, of course.
Well, they're certainly going to require a lot of money to, you know, develop a project like this, but we think it's just not viable. I mean, you mentioned that it's an arduous regulatory process.
Their words, not mine.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons it's so difficult is because they're planning to propose a huge megaport in the primary salmon spawning nursery in the Columbia River, which, you know, means some of the most important habitat in the Pacific Northwest. So it's going to be very difficult for them based on their own choices of just not looking at the ecosystem and not appreciating where they're trying to put this terminal.
There's been so much opposition from so many different quarters, and it seems fairly evident that the governor himself is against the project. Our elected representatives, our legislators, have had sort of curious responses to the whole matter. How do you trace the path of money and influence and power in Salem as it sort of flows through the project?
You know, there is widespread opposition to LNG, as much as I've seen in any issue, from the Farm Bureaus to the conservation groups to the renewable energy industry to landowners, property rights groups. I mean, it's an overwhelming opposition. Currently, there's a bill in front of the Oregon legislature called House Bill 3058 that's actually in front of the Senate now and will be decided on in the next couple of weeks. That would be a huge boon to the LNG companies. It was proposed by Bradwood Landing a couple years ago, and it would actually fast track the siting of these terminals by allowing them to get permits on private land to destroy wetlands and streams without the landowner's permission. So they couldn't start construction until they went through eminent domain, but they could get these permits, which would help them more quickly build the LNG terminal. So We're asking everyone to call their senator and ask them to vote no on 3058 and not help the LNG companies and other so-called linear utilities such as transmission lines and other pipeline companies.
It's and just briefly, one final question for you. It seems extraordinary to me that with so much public opposition that this can even... This whole idea of LNG in Oregon, how it even reached the stage that it's at now, how can that be explained?
Well, I think I think some people are taking a very short-sighted view of it and looking at, you know, the advantage of a couple years of short-term construction jobs versus the overall economic good for Oregon and developing a clean energy economy and protecting our current jobs in farming and the fishing industry, not out-competing solar with a glut of gas. So it's frankly shocking to a lot of people that their elected leaders would go for this misguided proposal to import foreign fossil fuel instead of a more long-term and wise shift to renewables and a clean and green energy future for Oregon.
Thank you so much for that, Brett. My guest has been Brett Vandenhoevel with Columbia Riverkeeper. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
First, it was a Las Vegas-style mega casino that tried to shoulder its way into Cascade Locks. Now the Nestle Corporation wants to draw 100 million gallons of water a year from a nearby salmon spawning stream to fill plastic bottles of Arrowhead and Pure Life water. The spring rises from three wooded spots above a state fish hatchery. Nestle must show that its withdrawals won't tap out the spring or city wells that would be used to replace spring water. The plant faces at least one vocal local opponent and faces national resistance from Food and Water Watch, a consumer group opposed to bottled water in general and Nestle's tactics in particular.
Nestle has a long and dark history behind it. It's worth taking a look at the company and what it's done in other parts of the world where it has managed to get a foothold. The 2005 oyster season in Willapa Bay, Washington, was a dismal failure, but not cause for serious alarm outside of the industry at first. Now, as the oyster industry heads into the fifth summer of its most unnerving crisis in decades, scientists are pondering a disturbing theory. They suspect that water that rises from deep in the Pacific Ocean may be corrosive enough to kill baby oysters. If true, that could mean shifts in ocean acidification associated with carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuels may be impairing sea life faster and more dramatically than expected.
In Washington state, Canada geese populations are declining. The Fish and Wildlife Department says biologists and volunteers will be capturing and banding up to 500 Canada geese by the end of the month in eastern Washington. This fall and winter, hunters will be asked to report when the banded birds are killed. It's part of a program they hope will explain a seven-year decline in nesting birds in parts of eastern Washington, even as complaints about urban geese increase.
But see, they're geese. They're birds. They fly back and forth between urban and rural areas. A company in Bend has got a new idea. Take thousands of tons of asphalt roofing shingle waste, once destined for landfills, and turn it into asphalt pavement. Portland's manufacturers generate 15,000 to 20,000 tons of shingle waste a year in the form of trimmings and sheets of factory seconds. Asphalt, of course, is made of oil, an aggregate, and it's often recycled. But use of asphalt shingle material is not standard and still must be approved by the Transportation Department.
Or we could try this. Portland-based Northwest Biogas has proposed using the tires and cow manure to make methane on a dairy farm. Turns out old tires and cow manure can mean clean energy at Three Mile Canyon Farms near Boardman, a town not known for its clean air credentials. The company wants a permit from the Oregon DEQ to store waste tires. As for the manure, the DEQ is holding informational meetings this week to discuss the waste tire storage permit application for a proposed anaerobic digester.
Of course, the nation isn't desperate. This isn't a depression. It's just a recession. It'll bounce back, right? Mm-hmm. What? We can't afford to keep the buses running, but we can afford a 12-lane super bridge over the Columbia River? The Portland Metropolitan Transit Agency, TriMet, plans a second round of service cuts this year. Bus routes were cut and Max Light Rail service decreased in controversial cuts finalized just 2 weeks ago. Those cuts take effect in September. The new proposal would increase fares and decrease bus service on about a dozen routes during low-use times.
Don't get sick after June. That's what they're saying on many Indian reservations these days. That's when federal health care dollars run out. This is especially catastrophic on the poorest reservations where residents can't afford health insurance. Officials say they have about half of what they need to operate, and patients know they must be dying or about to lose a limb to get serious care. The U.S. has an obligation, based on a 1787 agreement between tribes and the government, to provide American Indians with free public care on reservations, but that promise hasn't been kept. About one-third more is spent per capita on health care for felons in federal prison.
Oh, the ironies that abound in a post-petroleum depression. Springfield, Oregon is considering making it official. Homeless people can legally live in their cars. It's something of an American tradition, this living in cars. In this case, Springfield officials might allow homeless families to camp in recreational vehicles in church parking lots. See, they're RVs and they're in church parking lots, so it's okay.
Mm-hmm. This year's Portland Pride Parade featured 115 floats, 11 more than last year, and at least 13 religious organizations entered floats, 5 more than in 2008. Parade chairman Pat Olson says that increase shows that support is growing for the gay community. Members spent their morning singing to those crowded along the parade route and spreading their message of love for all people, no matter their sexual orientation. Portland Mayor Sam Adams met with more cheers than jeers as he waved to the crowded sidewalks from a bicycle, surrounded by other riders who held signs that read, "I'm with Sam."
President Barack Obama is due to make his case for a public-private health care plan today before the American Medical Association. The latest euphemism for the idea is a co-op. Independent journalist David Rosenthal is with us this morning to talk about the healthcare impasse. Good morning, David.
Hi, Chris. Good morning.
What does the term co-op actually mean?
It seems to mean something that is publicly funded but not run by the government. It's the trying to avoid the government-run catchphrase that has been used to target this idea. And really, you know, this idea of the public option, this has been two words that have just completely dominated the healthcare debate last week in Washington. And what we're really seeing now looks like a lot of compromise. We're seeing about, just 40 Republicans in the Senate and a dozen or so conservative Democrats who have been able to set the tone on this and are really ratcheting down this public option. And whether you call it a co-op or an option, I think the basic gist of it is people want a plan that they can dictate some terms that private insurers would have to then follow. And what we're seeing is this idea being whittled down to becoming something that would, in essence, be restricted in so much so that it would have to follow the insurance industry. And basically, you know, having it restricted in a way that we can't set the terms ourselves. And so this is really going to be the fight here. And I think, you know, it's causing a lot of people to ask, what kind of change are we getting with this new administration?
Do you see any actual benefit to what benefit would accrue actually to the public? Obviously, we know what the insurance companies stand to gain by this. But is there any at all? Is there any sort of, I don't know, silver lining here?
I think if lawmakers can stick to their guns on it and they create a plan that can establish certain things and pay for things in a way that makes sense and that a lot of people are pointing to as ways to reform, then the insurers and the other insurance plans will have to meet those standards that are set by the public option. The other thing that's been talked about is an insurance exchange, and this is the next thing that the industry is going to start tackling once they're able to dismantle this public option. It really seems like this is, you know, just one more step, and this is the exchange. The idea with that was that we would have an essential benefits package. And so I don't know. I think, you know, it's really starting to look like we're at a crucial time right now. I don't know if, you know, you kind of sense it in my voice, but I think it's very crucial right now.
Thank you so much for that. My guest has been independent journalist with the LundReport.org, David Rosenthal. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And finally, there hasn't been a sugar tax in the U.S. since 1764. The Senate Finance Committee is looking at bringing it back as a way to pay for Obama's health care reform. A federal excise tax would be placed on drinks containing sugar, high fructose corn syrup, and other sweeteners. Some medical experts believe that the tax would reduce consumption, thus help reduce obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Monday, June 15th, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Steve Nassar. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio station at 90.7 FM. Your support, and your support only, keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, If You Love This Planet, Dr. Helen Caldicott talks to marine ecology researcher Richard Thompson about the plastic garbage in the oceans and other marine ecology issues.
Thanks for listening and have a good day.